In our study of the book of 2 Samuel, this week and last week are sort of part one and part two that go together. So let me very, very briefly catch you up with last week. In our study of 2 Samuel last week, we picked up a key principle. That key principle is that we get the life we have by the path we choose. And that was kind of the central item. In fact, we talked last week how you make a decision. That decision may be a decision to lust, or maybe a decision to drink, or maybe it just be a decision to get angry, or make a decision to be lazy. But you make a decision, and you thought you just made a decision. No. You never just make a decision. What you do is you choose a path. And that path always takes you places and places you either wanted or didn't want to go. I mean, that works both for us and against us. You make a decision to be faithful. You make a decision to be righteous. You make a decision to be forgiving. You make a decision to be serving. And the path goes. And you thought you just made a decision. And lo and behold, it put you on a road. And that road delivers you wonderful places. And so last week, we talked about that concept. But few people can argue that a great portion of our lives didn't come about because it's the road we chose. Most of us cannot look at great portions of our life and go, well, gee whiz, I don't know how I became me. I don't know how that happened. The answer is I made a decision, and that decision made me on a path. We may argue that it really wasn't me who did it, but truth is, most of our portions of our life, it was us. Many years ago, Megan, she's our 22-year-old daughter, but many years ago, she was little. She had a bad cut on her arm, really. It was the kind of thing that was even dripping a little blood, and you're kind of going, gee whiz, child, whoa, stop, what is that? Megan looked at it, and she got this funny look on her face, and she said, I don't know. We said, well, where'd you do it? I don't know. I wasn't there when it happened. Now, that's a hard argument to maintain. I'm just telling you, that's a hard argument to maintain. By the same token, for me to say, you know, the life I have, I don't know how I got this silly thing. That's a hard argument to maintain for a good portion of my life. I mentioned last week, there's a book by Andy Stanley called The Principle of the Path. I used some ideas out of that book last week, and this week will as well. It's a helpful book. I want to encourage you to get that book if you get a chance. It's a wonderful book just to have for your own reading and to loan to people. But this week we want to layer in another portion of the picture, because a portion of my life is about the road that I chose, and a portion of my life is about the road other people chose for me. I mean, the both of those factor in here. We also gave the impression last week a little bit that if you'll just change roads, why, you can get back to what you want. And in many, many, many things, that's true. In matters of character, many, many things, if I just change the road I'm on, actually it will go a different place, the place I want to go. But there is a Jerusalem moment. There is a Jerusalem moment where we realize that some paths have taken me from my dreams, and I can't get those dreams back. I can't get back on a road that would take me back to those dreams. And there are dreams that I have to say goodbye to, because choices I made in my life or choices that other people made, that dream's not attainable. I like the metaphor of life being a bit of an hourglass, and so you take the hourglass and you set it up. The only problem is, in real life, the hourglass is glued to the table, and you don't get to flip it when you choose. And so a portion of our life, you look back and say, gee whiz, I would give anything to have that 20 years back, that 17 minutes back, but you can't flip the hourglass. It's gone. I like the fact that I can go to the clock on the wall and the hands can go either way. I can take them backwards if I want to. You know, when time changes or the battery has to be redone, you can just set the clock hands however you want to. But I realize in real life the clock hands are where they are, and I can't roll them back. And so there are people sitting in this room who know firsthand what it's like to say there are dreams I can never have. You see, you're in the car after the funeral, and the dreams are buried along with the casket. Oh, you recognize there are other dreams that may still be able to live, but the dreams you want to live or the dreams that were foremost in your mind, those dreams aren't there. And you have the stack of cards that everybody wrote, and you've got all the flowers that have been accumulated, and they're asking you whether you want this potted plant here or there, and you're riding home in the car. And when you do so, you realize, I can't flip the hourglass. There are dreams that I'm going to have to say goodbye to. Dreams I never dreamed I'd have to say goodbye to. For there's some of you who know firsthand what it's like to sit alongside the square outside the courthouse. And you sit there and you hold in your hands a piece of paper that tells you when your own children can sleep at your house and when your children can't sleep at your house. And you're going to go through a life where the dreams that you had and the hopes that you wanted, those dreams are not there now. Oh, there are other wonderful dreams that may be other places, but this dream dies in the way that you dreamed the dream. Others of you know about the wreck. Others of you know about the bankruptcy and the foreclosure. Others of you know about the pregnancy. You were 16 and life was just what it was, or you were 26, 30, I don't know what you were, but your girlfriend either said, I'm pregnant, or you were the girl, and life suddenly collided, and you go, wait a second, these are not the dreams. I didn't dream of being a 17-year-old girl raising a child by myself. How did this all happen? And dreams change. In your bulletin today is a reminder about the support groups that have started. One of them is entitled Empty Arms Support Group. It has to do with you gave birth to a child, where this child was almost born, but you had to say goodbye. How come those happen? Well, obviously they sometimes happen because we made choices. Had I known that was going to happen, I would have never taken that road. If I had any idea that alcoholism was going to follow, I would have never started on this. Had I ever known that this kind of buying that vehicle with that kind of speed would produce that kind of result, I never would have gone that route. Oftentimes, it's the decisions we made. It's the reason people who love each other cannot just play polite games with one another. Sometimes the greatest love is lived out in confrontation, going, I love you too much. You're too good a brother to me, not to say to you, do you know the danger you're running? And so we confront one another because we love one another. But sometimes there are choices other people made. We didn't make them. You're on a road you didn't choose. It's almost like you got kidnapped in life, and I'm on this road. I didn't want that. His affair or her affair or any number of things. How'd I get this road? This is the one thing I never thought I would have. And sometimes you just don't know why. Circumstances, I just am not on the road. I don't know. I thought they were God's dreams. I thought, but lo and behold, it seems like God's not even helping. It seems like God might be working against us. I don't know. I don't have the dreams. Again, I can stay too long on this. You fill in your own details. But many of you know what it's like to be the bridesmaid at 8 weddings. And you got the bridesmaid's dresses, but you've never had the dream you wanted. And why do other people seem to get the dreams, but you don't? For many of you, it's babies. How come other people, and they're rejoicing, and they're showing pictures of babies every year, and the nursery's full of babies, but I can't even walk down that hallway, because when I walk down that hallway, it just rips at my heart, because there are dreams that I had that I wanted, and I couldn't get them. For some, it was those of you that other people have healthy babies. Why? We love our child very much, but this isn't just 24/7. This is more intense than 24/7. What do you do with those dreams? I had a guy call me this week, and I appreciated his honesty, appreciate his friendship. And in the conversation, I'm going to use my words, not his, so that way you don't have to worry too much about figuring out who I'm talking about in language, but he said, how other people get careers, but I just get jobs. How come I never got a career? And now how come I can't even get a job? And other people get jobs, but I don't get a job. What's wrong with me? Why does nobody want me? Why can't I get the job? And then he was very honest, and he said this. He said, you know, I've never really struggled with lust. He said, in my lifetime, he said, as a male, he said, I guess maybe a few times I've gone back and said, you know, I need to repent about that thought or that idea. But he said, lust has never been my battle. He said, jealousy has been my battle. Because I look up, and he said, Randy, you have a job, and they pay you. And Randy, you've been in their place a long time. And he said, I hunger and I crave. Why doesn't somebody want me a long time? Why can't I stay somewhere and be given? And he said, I just struggle with that. A Jerusalem moment is going to occur when dreams on a consistent basis don't seem to work out. I'm going to tell you, this is a really important subject. The reason we gather on Sunday morning has to do with a lot of things, but one of the reasons is we're trying to figure out how to be passionate disciples of Jesus Christ who radically changed the world. That's what we're trying to do. We are people going, God, is there a word from God on how to be a passionate disciple of Jesus Christ? And looking for that, I want to be transformed so that my life can make a difference. This morning, we're on a teaching that is very, very hard. But if you're going to be a passionate disciple of Jesus Christ, you're going to have to be able to do that in the context of your Jerusalem moment, saying goodbye to dreams. And if you can't say goodbye to dreams in some faithful ways, you're going to really struggle on being a passionate disciple of His. I want to ride a hobby horse for a second, and it's what it is. It's what it is. I recognize that for many of us in this room, the dreams we have are such shallow dreams, and yet they tear us up. My goodness, how come we can't get the second bedroom added onto the house? Or how come we can't get the grass to grow? Or how come we can't seem to get that second car to ever run right? Or, I mean, there's dreams where we're just so upset because the world's falling apart on us. I mean, it's just horrible because that house won't sell or a dozen other things. The one that just has been so burdening to me, and it's just, it kept increasing, and it keeps coming back. I think it's part of God's just shoving and saying, look, you are a kingdom of people that are releasing the oppressed and the widows and the orphans. Let me tell you some people who have dreams. It's not their fault. Their crushed dreams came from somewhere else. Right now, there are kids who watch and kids who look in our culture, and they watch moms and dads put their kids in cars and watch moms and dads, you know, with kids wrestling in all kinds of places. And they watch families go in their house and they interact with all these kids at school and everywhere else. But they're in the foster care system. They're in the adoption pipeline system sitting out there. It's over 500,000 kids in this country waiting in the foster care system for some kind of permanency to their life. Of the over 500,000 kids that are in foster care system in this world, about 130,000 of those are adoptable. Of that 130,000 that are adoptable, about 30% will age out and never be adopted. Of the 30% that age out, 80% of them will end up in major catastrophe shortly afterwards, because of the lack of affection and care and structure in their lives. Of the 130,000 that are adoptable, the average age is 8. The average individual waiting to be adopted in this culture is 8 years old, and he or she has been waiting 39 months for someone to adopt them. And so you talk about hoped or crushed dreams and hopes. We're in a world where that happens on a consistent basis. And one of the things the churches of Jesus Christ is trying to rescue what sin destroys and what's so broken in the kingdom of God, you love people who've had crushed dreams. You look after the widows and the orphans. You look after them. What's the case of the 500 and some thousand kids in foster care system? The answer is pretty rugged. Pretty rugged. Oh, not for everyone. My goodness, no. There's wonderful stories, but oftentimes it involves siblings. And where do you put siblings? And the answer is in with good homes, but good homes are already overused. And so you got to break up siblings. And what do you do then with those that are good homes who really want kids? And what do you do with those who are just working the financial side of this thing? And what do you do with that whole issue? And so you've got kids struggling out there. I love what Life Bridge Church out of Longmont, Colorado did. I really do like it. They identified a program they wanted to do in their church. They just developed it. It's entitled Change Who's Waiting. The idea that you've got in Boulder County all these kids in foster care who are really waiting for good families, and the kids are waiting, that isn't right. The kids shouldn't be waiting, not with the kingdom of God that close by. We ought to change who's waiting. We ought to reverse it. We ought to reverse it in such a way that there's foster families that are waiting for kids. We need to reverse the deal. And they began to get involved in their congregation, and they qualified families for foster care, and they doubled the number of families, basically. I mean, it almost doubled it. First time in 30 years, Boulder County said we had more foster care parents waiting for kids than we had kids. They changed who's waiting. There's no doubt that when we have a message here about crushed dreams, there are many, many type stories like that, that God would turn to the kingdom of God and say, you be the answer to the prayer. You be the answer. You be a part of the solution. I made you to be a kingdom of priests, rescuers. Nobody here is going to say, by the way, adoption or foster care is easy. My goodness. Anybody who's adopted in this room knows that you can take a great deal of love and you put it into somebody's life, but the great deal of love doesn't take away the fact that there was something broken and there was some abandonment at some level. And so you have a collision of both this abandonment issue and this great deal of love, and they collide together in adoption. Anybody in this room would know that you put a great deal of love into somebody's life, but you don't put it in perfectly, and you too are flawed. And so there's even the things that you would want to do, and you don't do as well as you'd like to do. And you also know that even the child has to make a decision whether they're going to love or whether they... And so this it's a bit... It's not pristine. It's not pristine. But the Christian life is lived out with Jerusalem moments. Let me get back on track. What do you do? What do you do when you realize that your dreams and your hopes are not turning out the way you want them to? The answer for lots of people is, I think I will go ahead and destroy all the rest of my dreams as well. If I can't have the dream of my marriage, then here's what I will do. I'll become a woman who uses, or a man who uses alcohol and the drugs to numb my feelings, and I will sit and feel miserable in my house, and I'll be so tore up internally, and I will become promiscuous with anybody I date, and so I become a person whose personal dignity wasn't taken away by a courtroom. That tore my heart out when I had that divorce. But I chose to react so that I destroyed every other dream I could possibly have as well. And many of you know that story in this room. Many of you in this room know that your addictions, where they came from. Where they came from is I had a dream that died, and so I went ahead and destroyed everything else. I used some crazy reaction where I threw away every other dream. We all know on a humorous level. You see, in a lot of people, that when they have a broken hand and you ask them, oh, how'd you break the hand? And their answer to you is, well, do you want the truth or the story I prefer to make up? Well, what's the story you make up? Well, the story I make up is I was rescuing somebody and the car ran over it and it was really big, you know, a big deal. What's the truth? Truth was I was really mad that something broke and I hit the wall and I broke my hand. And you recognize that sequence happens a lot. For many in this room, you're lashing out on life. You've been lashing out a long time. You lost your job, but you're alienating your kids. You're alienating your wife. You're alienating your friends. You're taking what is broken, and in your Jerusalem moment, you're really struggling. And so you're destroying other dreams as well. Obviously, we could take that a while. Let's take the last few minutes we have. Let's get to the issue of the actual response. What do I do in my Jerusalem moment? You're going to have them. You're going to have them. What do you do? Here's our text. First thing you recognize that in your Jerusalem moment, you're not the first to have it, I guarantee you. In 1 Samuel, or in 2 Samuel, the 13th chapter, there's a rather horrible story that explains how David sort of ends up where he ends up. I don't want to go through the details of the story. It's not fun. Amnon is the oldest son of David, and Amnon has an extremely immoral choice that he makes involving his sister, and his sister Tamar is severely abused. She's raped. In fact, you could tell this whole story this morning from Tamar's perspective. What happens when you're on a road you didn't choose? What do you do in your Jerusalem moment? Now, David does not do anything. David's the king, and when the oldest son rapes his half-sister, David doesn't do anything. It says he's furious, but he didn't respond. I wondered about that. There's a lot of reasons why I think he may not have responded. One is because he has the embarrassment of his own compromised past. He has his own Bathsheba memory. So by what right do I have to go reprimand somebody else? That's one of the lies that comes out of sin, by the way. The lie keeps going. I think another reason might have been is that Amnon was the oldest and he was the heir. And if he actually does something, it brings the public spotlight on his family. And I think he might have been trying to keep the public spotlight. I don't know what reasons he used. I could maybe a couple more. But here's what I do know. David is my hero in many, many ways. There are many manly things about David. But David in this moment and David in a lot of his life is a relational coward. It was easier to stand up to a giant than it was to stand up to relational issues. And this relational coward, David, puts his family on a road, and he gets on a road partly by his own reactions and what he does with this. David doesn't do anything except get mad. Well, there's another half-brother to Amnon, the full brother to Tamar. He's a lot like David. His name's Absalom. He's a charismatic leader. He's got a man of action, and he's a man of some patience. And he says to his sister, don't do anything. Don't do anything. Implied in that is, I'll handle it. And he did. 2 years later, he kills his brother. And so Absalom, the son of David, kills Amnon, the son of David. When Absalom kills his brother, he runs off in exile. And again, David doesn't do anything. He just has a brother off in exile. In fact, he would have left him in exile, this relational coward David, not responding and behaving. By the way, don't sell manhood out for slaying giants in a valley. Don't you see manhood only with that kind of action. You better see manhood as having the full umbrella, and David violates that portion of it. There's a wonderful text in here where a gal comes in and tells a story and helps to bring the reconciliation where Absalom comes back. But when Absalom comes back, even there it's inadequate. Look at chapter 14, verse 33. In chapter 14, the 33rd verse, so Joab went to the king and told him this. Then the king summoned Absalom, and he came in and bowed down with his face to the ground before the king. And the king kissed Absalom. You know, as a beginning of the story, that's wonderful. It's not the beginning of the story. It's the end of the story, basically, on their relationship. That's all it is. Nothing more happens. A father-son is never reconciled. Justice is never dealt with. Issues are left unavoided. And so what takes place is Absalom takes 4 years and undermines his father and pulls a revolt. And when he pulls a revolt, even trusted counselors leave David's staff to go and become the counselor to Absalom. And Absalom declares himself king, and David has to run for his life. And Absalom is bringing an army to conquer his father. And that takes us to the text that we were in chapter 15, verse 30. That's where David is walking up the hill, Mount of Olives, and he's weeping, and his head is covered, and his feet are bare, and you have this Jerusalem moment. Why does David have that moment? The answer is, I've lost a son to murder. I've lost a son to rebellion. I've lost a daughter's dignity because my family's so broken. And I'm about to lose my life and everything else. But even that's not the total picture. You need a visual picture that occurs just a little bit later. There's a guy named Shimei. As David leaves, there's a guy named Shimei who is a family member of the former king, King Saul, who runs along the top of the bank alongside the road and throws rocks and dirt clods at King David, just pelting him. You murderer, you. You bloodletter, you. You scoundrel, you. You dog, you. You horrible man, you. He just, this old guy Shimei is throwing rocks. One of David's men says, let me go kill him. And in his Jerusalem moment, there is some clarity that David begins to hang on to. His clarity is, no, don't kill him. My own son has rebelled against me. Why should I worry when somebody else has rebelled? And then he says this, what if God has sent him? What if God himself has put his hand on that man to bring this against me? No, let him be. Let him be. David's Jerusalem moment is one that everybody in this room had better wrap their hands around, because it has come to you or will come to you where you better figure out what are you going to do when the dreams you have for your life don't seem to be coming about. David's answer is in chapter 15, verses 25 and 26. Take the ark of God back into the city. The priest said, here, we'll bring the ark with you. We'll bring the ark. By the way, I'm guessing there was some spiritual manipulation probably going on there, but I don't know that. David says, no, take the ark of God back into the city. If I find favor in the Lord's eyes, he'll bring me back. And he'll let me see it in his dwelling place again. But if God says I'm not pleased with you, then I'm ready. Let God do to me whatever seems good to him. That's an incredible passage. Here's what the passage is. It's a passage of surrender. It's a passage that says, I don't know what else to do with my life other than what I've known from the core truth that I had when I was a child. I am God's, and he is my creator, and he is my sustainer. And I have no right to manipulate my dreams. I have no right to impose my world. I am his, and let him do with me what he wants. What he does will be enough. That is a hard, hard thing to say. Whatever God does with me is enough. But that's the haunting question that you have to wrestle with yourself. Have I ever come to the place in my life that my following the kingdom has nothing to do with the preeminence and prominence of my own dreams? But if all of my dreams died around me, am I willing to say, God, here I am in my Jerusalem moment. You do with me whatever you do with me. You who see the perspective of my life through eternity, and I see the perspective of my life through this slice. God, I surrender to you. I am the clay. You're the potter. Here's the bottom line, I'm yours. It's interesting, I'm going to do one other little thing with the text here, and then I'll kind of push a little further. David does with God exactly the same thing that a friend did with David. Look at 2 Samuel 15, verse 21. There's a guy named Ittai. Ittai is new to the friendship and allies of David, but he is a friend and an ally of David. And as David is leaving the city in exile and mourning and torn up, Ittai comes and says, I'm going to go with you. David responds back to Ittai, and here's what he says. Don't go. Don't go with me. Stay. Stay. Ittai replies. But Ittai replied to the king, as surely the Lord lives, and as my lord the king lives, whatever my lord the king may be, whether it mean life or death, there will your servant be. This guy says, I don't care what the future holds, life or death, I'm with you. David takes that same phrase and repeats it back to the Lord. On Tuesday of this week, I went and pulled out old correspondence that I had. I've got a series of notes and series of letters from an old friend who used to be in this congregation. Her name was Janice Davis. You got to go back in the late 80s to know who Janice was. Janice got a diagnosis of terminal cancer that was less than a year in her prognosis. And so Janice was a single gal in the congregation, and we walked through with Janice. Julie sitting here would have a memory of it. So many of you would. We walked through with Janice. Janice was a single gal, and watched her hopes and dreams die. She dreamed of being married someday, and that one. And she dreamed of her own family, and that dream died. She dreamed of a long life and the things that we all dream about. And bit by bit, those... She lived until the early 90s. In her correspondence, in fact, I got up this morning, went and took one of them, reread it again this morning. In it, and I'm going to use my language, it's easier. But she said, I really struggled with all of this. I really struggled. I kept thinking, God, protect me from this. God, stop this. God, you're able. God, you could do this. And she said, as long as I kept seeing the cancer and I kept seeing all these dreams that were dying, and God, you're not helping on this. And she said, it just was a hard emotional roller coaster. In fact, she said, God didn't seem to answer any of my prayers. I'd pray for God for a healing, and I didn't get that. And then I'd pray, God, kill me, and I didn't get that. And she said, God had to be going, well, make up your mind, one or the other. Which one do you want? And she's going, but I kept having just according to what life was happening. But she said, I never really got peace. I never really got peace till I came to the place to realize that I don't think God sent the cancer, and I don't think he caused it. But when I finally came to the place of going, God, my cancer is in your hands, and I have to see my cancer as coming from your hand as much as anything else. God, my life and my cancer are both in your hands. You do what you want. She said, that's when peace came. When my cancer and my life were both there, that's when peace came. I believe that's true for about everybody in Jerusalem moment. You can fight and you can struggle and say, God, but this was a good dream, and God, this is this, and God, this is right. But until you come to the place that you say, God, I am finite, and God, you're infinite. And God, I am not going to manipulate anything. God, if you choose to use my life in prosperity, fine. If you choose to use me in poverty, that's fine. God, if you choose to use me with a long life, that's fine. God, if you choose to use me with a short life, I'm yours. God, you didn't call me to the spa. You called me to the cross. And I will follow you. I know of creation. I know of the cross. I know of your character. Whatever you bring, God, I am willing to be yours. Christianity in this country, John Stott said this, Christianity in this country, the Western background, he said, we talk about making commitments to the Lord, commitments that depended upon the circumstances we keep or don't keep. But the scripture always speaks in terms of surrender. And surrender has nothing to do with conditions. Surrender has nothing to do with conditions. God, if Julie lives a long life, I'll be faithful. God, if you give Julie and I good health, God, if you give us this, there is no condition I can make with the Lord. Surrender is all I got. And in the Jerusalem moment, I have to decide what I have. Do I have a commitment to the conditions, or is it a surrender? And what am I? And David's surrender is the key. By the way, you need to know that God's dreams for David didn't end when David's weeping. David's crying, but God's dreams don't end there. But David had no way of knowing that. He is weeping. I believe that same thing will be true for you. God's dreams will not end for your life. You may not know till heaven's gates of the applause of angels for the hard road you took. You may never know what the surrender of the dreams you had liked to have held on gave birth in eternal ways to other things that you had no way of knowing. But it is hanging on to those that forces me to decide whether I'm going to be a follower of the living God or whether I'm resistant. I went running this last week as the praise team comes up. I went running last week, about a week and a half ago. And it was one of those mornings where there was a mist about 5.5, 6 feet above the ground. And it was heavy mist, heavy fog in that band. And because of the cross-country track at Southern, you're running in and out of it all the time. And so when I was up on top of the hills, you were above it. It was a beautiful, sunshiny morning. I mean, just glistening off all the moisture. But as soon as you'd go into that little band, honestly, you couldn't see very well. And the main thing it did is it fogged up your glasses. And I would get my glasses fogged up when I passed it. And literally, I am running where I cannot see anything in front of me except just a few steps in front of me because my glasses are that fogged up. And you would come back out of it, and your glasses would eventually clear, and you're back on, and you can see. Much of our life is going to be that in and out, in and out, in. Moments I see clearly, and moments I don't see well at all. In your Jerusalem moment, will you choose to say what David said? God, I don't care. The last hour, one of the families that came down to pray with me, family said, you know, we're in the middle of our Jerusalem moment. And they talked about their prayer last week and their prayer today. God, I have nothing to hang on to but you. But you're enough. You're enough. I want to ask you, you grew up a manipulator. I know you did. From the time we were little kids, we learned to manipulate. You learned to take the toy you were tired of and the toy you didn't want and act like it was the neatest toy in the world so you could trade with for the toy you did want. And you got what you wanted by playing a game. We got better at it in school. We all sort of learned a little bit of the Tom Sawyer, Huck Finn. Boy, whitewashing a wall is a wonderful thing. Boy, wish you could all whitewash a wall like this. And we manipulate. And we come in as Western Americans with this terrible ego. I deserve the American dream. I deserve everything. I deserve to have. I want this. I have the right to this. And we say to God, God, I'll worship you as long as you protect my nest egg. But at some point in time, you got to decide, God, if I have no other dream but you, it's enough. It's Ezekiel in chapter 24, where God says to him, Ezekiel, you're going to lose the delight of your eyes. And you drop one paragraph, and it says, and that morning I spoke to the people, and that evening my wife died. And you read the rest of Ezekiel's ministry. We all live in a world where I've got to decide, God, no manipulation. I'm not trading anything. God, I have nothing with you. God, I'm either yours or I'm not. You do with me as you please. The neat part about it is there's always a resurrection to those stories. You see, David gets a resurrection. Oh, by the way, did you notice where that walking up, what mountain was that? What hill was that he was on? Mount of Olives. By golly, I think I've heard of that before. In fact, there's somebody else who walked up the Mount of Olives who was betrayed by their counselors. There was somebody else who was really the king, and others said, oh, you're no king. There was somebody else who climbed up that in tears, saying, God, if it be possible, let this cup pass from me. But the dreams of God still go through the death of our own dreams, and lo and behold, the dreams of God explode. You tell me, what are you doing in your Jerusalem moment? What are you doing on your Mount of Olives?